This is KBLULP in Logan. My name is Richard Arlen Blake, and I'd like to welcome you all back to my next episode of Balladish and Ish Folklore Now. Last time I spoke, I talked about how different regions of the country have their own unique cultures and their own unique aspects of them that are really important for us to understand and to appreciate. And I mentioned that I would probably be going out and doing specific regions to do different kinds of folklore of each of these different regions of the United States. And I had decided that, well, I'll probably go over several of the 50 states and use those as my compass for deciding what to talk about with this particular episode. I had talked about doing maybe Virginia or Vermont or New Hampshire, but after making a few considerations, I actually decided on the state of Rhode Island. My reason for doing that might seem a little strange to you, but it essentially is based on this. Back in sixth grade, I was given the task of writing a report about a specific state. All the class was given a different state in order to write about, and somehow I ended up with the state of Rhode Island. Of course, I wasn't all that excited about it at first because this is the smallest state in the Union. We never really hear about it in our history books, so why should I be excited about doing this? Why couldn't you give me something else? Basically, that was because what I considered the more interesting states were already taken. I have no idea why I ended up with probably the last or next to last choice. Maybe I was sitting in the back of the class at the time, I'm not sure. But other than basic things like, okay, the Rhode Island state bird is the Rhode Island red chicken, the state flower is the common blue violet, and the state tree is the red maple. That's basically a lot of the stuff that you get when you hit the beginning of the Rhode Island section in any almanac that you might be looking it up in. And of course, it gives you a bunch of historical facts as well. But you do have to really kind of delve into it, and you start to see several things that are not really mentioned in the general history books unless you are zeroing in on Rhode Island specifically. So, historically, anyway, Rhode Island was a colony that was established in 1636 by Roger Williams. He was once of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He ended up getting booted out of there by the Puritans who ran the place because he was preaching things that were contrary to the accepted doctrines of the people there. And that is a little bit ironic considering the people who founded the Massachusetts Bay Colony were fleeing a kind of persecution of their own where they can go worship God as they pleased. He ended up heading south to what we know today as Rhode Island. What he set up was the colony of the Providence and Rhode Island plantations. After he settled there, other people would follow him. You'll notice if you read the history books that there is a lot of religious reasons that people ended up migrating up out into the area of Rhode Island. When it was founded, Rhode Island ended up being the seventh British colony of people here in the New World. As we look at a few things, when we think of the size of Rhode Island, there are a lot of jokes that have come out about Rhode Island that if you're driving through that area and you sneeze, you would have missed it. And there are ranches in Wyoming that are bigger than the state of Rhode Island, or oil slicks in the state of Alaska or off the coast of Alaska are bigger than the state of Rhode Island. And there, people have a lot of fun with that sort of thing when they're talking about Rhode Island. One of the interesting things about Rhode Island, of course, is that though it's a small size, it is one of the most densely populated areas in the country. That's why it has more representatives representing that state than do the states of Montana or Wyoming or Nebraska, I think, only has one as well. If you look at the, you know, dense population, of course, it makes for a much more urbanized region. And the culture, of course, is reflected with that. Besides, of course, the size of Rhode Island, there are some things that the Rhode Islanders take great pride in. One of their stories involves the American Revolution. They claim that back in 1772 that they were actually the first ones to fire the first shot during the American Revolution. Now, during Lexington and Concord, which we consider the opening of the American Revolution, the shot heard around the world, and all those other things. We look in Rhode Island, and they have, in 1772, a ship named the Gaspee that the British had going through that region of Rhode Island near Block Island, where they were trying to cut down on pirates and smugglers because the colonists there were constantly trying to smuggle things in and out of there without having to pay their taxes and their dues. So the British would send some of these ships around to make sure there's none of that smuggling going on. Well, a man named John Brown, who lived nearby the Block Island region, he decided to take advantage of a situation. He rounded up several boats of people and went and they attacked the Gaspee there as it was beached near Block Island. He ended up seizing the ship, capturing the people there, and he burnt the ship and sent it off to sink into the sea. And of course, they think that that is the first shot of the American Revolution, is when we did that. It is an interesting idea that that is the true first shot of the American Revolution, but there wasn't widespread outright revolt acknowledged until 1775. But the Rhode Islanders did play a part there in the beginning, and they should not be denied that aspect of their pride in their culture and their revolutionary ties. Another thing that they pride themselves on is being one of the big introductory instigators of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. So back in 1790, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, is where Slater's Mill was established, and that was a textile mill that would gradually build up into one of the major industrial textile industries in the United States. And from that, of course, other industrial areas arose in the states of Massachusetts and Virginia, and then gradually into the rest of the country. Now, I was trying to decide where the best place would be to take it from here. After all, when I hit Rhode Island as the topic of this podcast, I want to hit many different areas and not just one specific kind of folklore as opposed to another one. And I was looking as best I could to find things in what, of course, is called the food ways of folklore. And one of the things that came up, and this is the one I'm going to talk about because this is one of the few ones I've actually heard about, and therefore I can say a few things about it as opposed to pulling up something and hoping that no one catches the fact that I don't know what I'm talking about when I'm doing this. I'm just reading somebody else's stuff or whatever. But one of the areas, or one of the food aspects of folklore in Rhode Island, is something that is called pizza strips or Italian tomato pie. It's known throughout New England, but Rhode Island has its own certain type of tomato pie. It's a certain thickness of bread as opposed to what you might find in, say, Massachusetts or Connecticut nearby or any other place where you might find it. Basically what it is it's tomato sauce and bread that's kind of mixed together, and sometimes they'll put Parmesan cheese and a couple other things on it, but it's like a quick, simple recipe that they put things together. I talked to a couple people who do this, and what they end up doing is besides just Parmesan cheese and tomatoes, they, you know, a few vegetables can wind up on there as well, and I don't know if that makes it officially non-Rhode Islandish. But anyways, these are traditional things of that particular region of the United States. I tried it once, and I don't know, I think it's kind of an acquired taste. He was really excited about it when he showed this to me, And so I, of course, followed through and said, okay, yeah, that's pretty good, and tried to kind of divert the topic away from that because, I don't know, maybe my California senses or whatever just don't quite correlate with the people in New England. It just shows you that every area has its own kind of recipes and things that are distinct to them, kind of like Indian food, where some people think it burns their tongues off, while others think that, okay, we do like this kind of spicy food. When you go to a certain place, so let's say I was going to go to Rhode Island, and you're thinking, oh, let's go get some traditional Rhode Island food or New England food, and sometimes what the tourist instinctively does is just go to McDonald's or KFC, something that's familiar to them, and just pick it up because they know they like it. It's there, it's available, so why not? But if you go onto the Food Network or the Cooking Channel, you see all of these people that are going out there and trying to push the regional food. You know, this is the great food of this restaurant or this region, or this is the place where this particular recipe originated. In New England, they have a lot of older ideas that crossed over from different countries, people who migrated there. Since the word Italian tomato pie is often mentioned, I'm assuming, and it's kind of a pizza type thing, so it does make sense that it does have an Italian origin to it. Italians were coming to America in larger numbers as the 20th century was coming around. And then, of course, after World War II, some more Italians showed up as well. But I have a feeling that this tradition, these pizza sticks, are pretty much a byproduct of a bit of Italian idea mixed with American either ascetism, you know, kind of cutting back on using too many items on their food, or they're kind of short on a large number of items that they might have used on this pizza, so they just make it really simple and then they eat it. And then, of course, they grow up with that, and it's something that they really appreciate. And it's really interesting, of course, how they do a lot of these things. Unfortunately, I'm a kind of a picky eater, and it's something that I am trying to overcome, because how can you be a folklorist and not actually appreciate the food that all these other cultures have to offer, as opposed to the KFC or McDonald's that you're always going to, or even just your local American restaurant where they have Americanized versions of food. I mean, there are a few things that are pretty much American because we've kind of created a certain sort of way of doing things. If you were to go to Italy and you wanted pizza like they have at Pizza Hut, trust me, you're not going to find it unless you make it, you know how to make it yourself. So even here in the United States, you do have regional foods that are distinct to those people. The next thing I'm going to do is I am going to be telling stories for the rest of this podcast. Being a maritime folklorist, largely a maritime folklorist, and someone who's interested in ghost stories, I have a couple maritime things and a ghost story that I want to share with you that isn't maritime. All three of these deal with ghosts, and part of the reason for that is it's a lot easier to find ghost stories nowadays than it is to find regular old folk tales, unless I was to go to a folk center in Rhode Island to get them, or I knew some people in Rhode Island. I was working on trying to get a hold of some Rhode Island stories so that I can use them here that weren't necessarily ghost stories, but at least I was able to find some things that weren't maritime ghost stories that I could lay out here and talk to you about. One of the places that came up when I was researching Rhode Island and its folklore is there is a haunted tavern in the town of Newport, Rhode Island. This is called the White Horse Tavern, and it dates back to 1673 when someone named William Hayes, he made renovations to an existing building that was built there about two decades before that, and it was made into a tavern and an inn. This particular tavern has been in that particular family's ancestry ever since, with like one or two exceptions. And when you go through the story and the history of this tavern, it's some of the ghosts that you find there are rather, you can kind of tell what time period they originate in. And it's kind of sad that most of these ghosts, they don't know the names exactly. They don't know who these people are. They can judge by their dress or the way they walk, maybe what kind of period or culture that they were around in. One of the owners of this tavern was a pirate who was being protected by the local people because he was a local themselves, and this was during the colonial times, and of course the British were cracking down on pirates. And this Hayes, I think he was William Hayes Jr. actually, he eventually got caught up with the wrong side of the British authorities, and they got a hold of him and they hanged him. And then, of course, they moved on to other members of that family. And one of the ghosts that supposedly haunts this place is actually the ghost of William Hayes Jr. Like I said, a lot of times in the past, that sometimes it's a violent death, a violent ending, destructive ending that actually causes these ghosts to be left behind in the places where they once lived or where they died. He obviously didn't die in the tavern, but his ghost is there, people believe, because that place meant a lot to him. Then along with William Hayes Jr., of course, the place is haunted by a colonial figure who dates back to the 1720s, is what it says, and he has been seen by staff and guests dressed in common shabby colonial attire. Most often he's like in the main dining room or upstairs. And, of course, that makes you kind of wonder, why would people go there if they knew the place is haunted, if they're going there to eat? But, of course, like I said before, legend trippers, you know, they like to go and they like to see ghosts. And apparently seeing this ghost does not scare them enough that they don't want to go back and go and see the place for themselves. Maybe they think, well, this guy's not bothering anybody, so I shouldn't make a big deal out of it. And there's also the people have heard a girl crying that wanders around the store, wanders around the pub. She's usually heard crying near the bathroom on the second floor when nobody's there. You're going, okay, who the heck's crying? And you're walking around, and of course you hear footsteps walking around places, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, that's got to be a ghost. And I don't know about you, but I've been places where I thought I'd heard footsteps, but it didn't immediately occur to me that there was a ghost making that sound. And then the last one, there's some unknown female that has been seen floating above the dining tables. It was captured on photo, according to some people, and sometimes you hear heavy footsteps going around in unoccupied rooms. If I can ever get myself down to Exeter, Rhode Island, I'm definitely going to check this place out. But even if I don't see a ghost, seeing these really old buildings that date back to colonial times and they're kept up in somewhat original form, I do think that that is always worth seeing. Whether or not you see a ghost, being in places where things happen, being in places that have just stayed, they had staying power, and they have been there forever, I believe those are always worth going and seeing. So the next place I'm going to go now is Block Island again here off the southern coast of Rhode Island. So I've already mentioned Block Island as it relates to the American Revolution and how some people believe that Rhode Island started the revolution by what happened at Block Island. Now I'm going to talk about other things that happened at Block Island that are really kind of more creepy and more interesting in my opinion. Not that I'm not interested in the American Revolution, but when it comes to ghosts, those always seem to perk me up to increase my interest in any place. So the first thing I'm going to talk about then is the ship that was known as the Princess Augusta. So the Princess Augusta had sailed out of the Netherlands and was carrying a bunch of religious refugees from Europe to the United States. They were trying to set up a new life here in the United States to get away from religious persecution. because during that time there was definitely a lot of religious animosity going on in certain places. That is part of the reason why the United States was founded. So in 1738, the Princess Augusta anchored off the coast of New England, and it was carrying 150 German Palatines, which were a religious organization, and they were the survivors of a much larger crew, some of which had died along the way. I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories about would-be colonists who took a dangerous route across the Atlantic to get to America to set up a new life, and they died along the way. All of those, of course, are tragic, but this one is a little bit more sinister. So these people were trying to get to Philadelphia. What happened was, depending on who you listen to, the ship ended up wrecking off the coast of Block Island. Now, on Block Island, there is a lighthouse that helps to guide people. What some people say is the ship came and it crashed onto the island, and the local inhabitants went out and helped these poor souls and fed them, took care of them, and they resided there on Block Island. But if you believe another story, something much worse happened. It is believed that the residents on Block Island were wreckers. You know, they'd wreck ships coming in, they'd crash into the rocks or whatever, and then they'd go plunder the goods off of these ships. And what happened then was there was a false light put out by these wreckers to get this ship to come and crash into the reefs or the unsafe areas near Block Island. And what happened was these wreckers, they went out and they plundered the ship. They ended up they either dragged them off the ships and killed them or killed them on the ship. I'm not sure which. Then what they did is they set fire to the Princess Augusta and then shoved it back into the ocean, you know, back into the waters. They watched it sink back under the water. That would eliminate all trace of the horrible things that these Block Islanders had done to these Palatines. In one particular story, it is said that there was one woman who remained on board that ship, and she was standing on the edge of the ship looking out as the boat was aflame and going under. She was screaming and screaming as the ship was going under the water. The ship itself, the Princess Augusta, is destroyed and it goes under. And the Block Islanders and the other people thought, well, that was the end of that, and moved on with their lives. However, what happened after that was certainly really scary to the people of Rhode Island as a whole and the rest of the nearby coastal regions. Once a year, well, not necessarily only once a year, but they love saying once a year, something keeps coming up in a lot of these stories. But the Princess Augusta is often seen suddenly reappearing out of the darkness or out of the mists. It is a bright ship form that it's like a ghostly light, and it's like the ship is still burning and on fire as it sails across through that area and before it disappears, of course, because these ghost ships don't stick around for a very long amount of time. And when that ship goes by, they can hear that woman screaming, and it haunts the people of Block Island, the sinister reminder of the horrors that those people did to these Palatines off the coast of Block Island. And so I'm not sure how often it's supposed to happen, because there's conflicting stories, which is the nature of the folktale. You have more than one story. There are a lot of people who have said they have seen this Palatine light, as they call it, because the name of the ship itself, I think, has been forgotten by a lot of people. They think the ship is actually called the Palatine, but the Palatines are the people who were on board the ship and died there. And this ship comes out, it's really bright, it lightens up the darkness, and so they call it the Palatine Light. And it's similar to the teaser light that is seen off the coast of Nova Scotia, where a ship kind of blew up out there when it was resisting the British. Of course, this story continues on and on until this day. And there are people in modern days who have claimed to see it. By modern, I mean in the last 30 years. I don't mean like yesterday. I don't know if people are less inclined to talk about their experiences with the Palatine Light. There are plenty of people who are willing to listen to them, but I guess they don't want to be considered a bunch of crackpots claiming they saw a ghost ship. And even though on the internet there's a welcome place for them to tell their stories, you can go to places like Creepypasta and other things to tell your stories, and some of them will be believed and others it won't be. And so it's probably, you know, stories will continue about the Palatine Light and about this ghost ship. The other thing that I want to talk about, this is my other ghost story that I want to mention. This one deals with the lighthouse itself. The ghost story here goes like this. There was a lighthouse keeper that came to the southeast lighthouse with an angry wife in tow. You know, no woman seems to want to be dragged somewhere that she doesn't want to go and live with her husband on some rock somewhere. So the keeper didn't have an easy job at this lighthouse. You know, no lighthouse job was glamorous at the time, but it was made much worse by the nagging of his wife. This nagging had built up over time until eventually the lighthouse keeper couldn't take this anymore, and he ended up throwing her down the stairs of the residence there by the lighthouse, and that ended up killing her. The keeper, of course, was caught, and they found out what he had done. They convicted him of his wife's murder, and then he was taken away to prison. His wife, however, had other plans. Her ghost actually remains behind to harass the future keepers of this lighthouse. They show, often people have seen pots flying around that have been thrown by this ghost, and clothing has been hidden or moved around. Tools have been rearranged, and locks have been opened and closed by the mischievous ghost that was married to this lightkeeper. In one instance, one of the lightkeepers, after the one who killed his wife, was asleep in bed, and there was a huge scream that just woke him up. He jumped out of bed and he ran outside thinking, oh my gosh, what the heck's going on? So he was terrified of this strange ghostly voice that had woken him up. And then after he'd gotten his wits about him, he finally decided to go back inside. But then he suddenly discovered that the lighthouse door was locked and he couldn't get inside. And his keys were actually locked inside there, and so he couldn't get at them. How he ended up eventually getting back inside, the story doesn't say, but this is an instance then where an angry ghost that didn't like being there in the first place dies there and ends up sticking around. That is the strong emotional tie that this woman had to the lighthouse that kept her around. The lighthouse keeper that killed his wife, of course, wasn't the nicest person in the world. But they make it clear in this instance that the wife herself was definitely no saint. And so many times husbands and wives get into spats, and being a lighthouse keeper, he just couldn't take it anymore and did the unthinkable, as we would call it. Today, these lighthouses are all automated, and they're run, you know, by an automated system that'll light up the way for ships to come. There are no more wreckers on Block Island. There are still people who will go to these lighthouses to get this experience. One of the things dealing with lighthouses I've mentioned in another podcast deals, of course, with people who go to different lighthouses in order to get these stamps on a passport that give them official recognition as a traveler and a lover of lighthouses. So a lot of people do go and visit this particular lighthouse, this region. I'm not sure just how many people are actually allowed into the lighthouse itself. Some of these lighthouses are off limits to visitors to the area. And there's always, though, Park Service people or Lighthouse Service people who are there to lead people around. This island, this lighthouse can be visited by tourists or visitors. And you can hear all kinds of stories about the history behind this particular lighthouse. This lighthouse is fairly old, but it has to be renovated quite a few times. The original lighthouse on the island was in another location, but it ended up getting into disrepair, and so they ended up moving it over to the southern part of the island. The places around Rhode Island, of course, there's so many different stories that deal with shipwrecks off the coast of Rhode Island. People who make stupid mistakes trying to sail around one of the capes or going through places at night. There's a ghostly light that is purported to lead a lot of sailors off into wrong directions. Sailors have to be extra careful going around the capes around southern Rhode Island, or, you know, if they end up following the guidance of these particular lights, they will find themselves crashing into areas that no ship is supposed to go to. Now, finally, the last story that I want to talk to you about isn't a ghost story, but it is an interesting story in my opinion. It is a tall tale out of Rhode Island. It does not say exactly where it originated, but it is a Rhode Island story, and so I thought it was worthy. And this one is called Old Stormalong and the Octopus. And so I'm actually going to read this to you from the American Folklore website, because I think that this really tells the story better than I ever could. I would have to sit and rearrange a few things, and it still definitely wouldn't sound as good as this. So this is how it goes. So one day, Old Stormalong, the ultimate sailor, was sailing the course through the deepest part of the Atlantic Ocean when a particular large wave knocked the anchor loose. The anchor plunged right down to the bottom before the sailors could reel her in, and it got caught on something. The big ship lurched to a halt, and the sailors rushed hither and thither, back and forth, trying to figure out how to shake the anchor loose. Finally, Old Stormalong pushed the sailors aside and gave the anchor a tug himself, but that anchor was stuck firm. The sailors begged Stormalong not to pull at it again, but they were afraid that he would wrench a hole in the bottom of the world and all of the water would spill out into space. So Old Stormalong, he decided to go down to the depths of the sea to see if he could unhook the anchor from whatever it was that was tangling it. Taking a knife between his teeth, Old Stormalong dove into the water. For a few minutes, nothing happened. Then the water below the massive ship began to bubble and churn. The waves grew higher and higher until the ship was tossed around like a rubber duck in the bathtub. Even the old sailors grew seasick and clutched the rail, groaning aloud. After a few minutes, the waves started to calm, and then Old Stormalong popped his head out of the water. "She's good to go, boys. Hoist anchor," he shouted. Old Stormalong climbed aboard while his men hoisted the giant anchor. As soon as they caught their breath, the sailors asked their captain why the anchor had gotten stuck on the bottom. "It was a giant octopus playing games down in one of the canyons," Old Stormalong said. "It took a hold of the anchor with four legs and was using the other four to hold on to the bottom of the sea." "How did you get the anchor loose?" asked the first mate. "Well, I just wrestled the old whale bait until it shouted for mercy, and then tied its arms into double carrack bends. It will take the better part of a month for that knot to come undone." And then, of course, definitely a tall tale. Most tall tales are far-fetched and outlandish. But, of course, when the storyteller is out telling it, it's always... This could register a laugh, but not all tall tales are humorous to people. This one is certainly in the genre of those far-fetched things that really capture the imagination. And who knows, some sailors back in really superstitious times may have actually believed that story. But that is all that I have to say here about Rhode Island. There are several other things about Rhode Island that one can say as well, but of course I don't have time to talk about it. The nation's smallest state is full of all kinds of stories, all kinds of things, and it doesn't matter its size. It's much smaller than California, but it still has a lot of great things to offer. As I prepare for doing the next podcast, I'll probably do it with another eastern state before I head west. I'm not sure which one I'm going to do yet. I want to pick another state that a lot of people don't talk about too much so that people can understand what it is, that can understand that everywhere you go in this country, you will find folklore, you will find traditions, you will find stories, and you will find stories that will suit just about anyone's taste. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of Baladishanish Folklore Now. And as always, if any of you have any ideas or stories about songs or anything, if you have your own recordings that you would like me to play on here, so far no one sent me any recordings or any ideas that I can talk about here, so I really would love to hear from people out there anything you have to say. Just send your ideas to folklorenow33@gmail.com. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on the next episode of Baladishanish Folklore Now.